Good morning, Dr. D'Souza. Thank you so much for being willing to join us today to teach us a little bit about treatment and management of skin cancers. So in looking on your website with Forest Dermatology, it sounds like you're a native of Oklahoma, but you've been here in the Asheville area, and that you are, in addition to being a general dermatologist, a Mohs surgeon. So if I've got any of that wrong, please correct me, but would love to just hear you introduce yourself.
Yes, no, you're spot on about all those things. Yes, born and raised Tulsa, Oklahoma, did all my undergrad medical school there. Not sure what the University of Connecticut wanted with a kid from Oklahoma, but did my internship, residency, and fellowship all at UConn. And it was a great experience, but too much snow. So lucky to be here, lucky to be here in Asheville, and I've been here now the better part of a decade. It was on our radar because my wife was born on the Air Force Base out in Goldsboro, so she always talked about how beautiful this area of the country was, and yeah, just lucky to have found a really wonderful job at Forest Dermatology.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much. We are so glad to have you here. So, you know, our network is a big variety of folks treating patients all across the spectrum of ages and socioeconomic statuses and obviously different conditions that we're trying to help people with. But as an expert in the treatment and management of skin cancers, would love to hear a little bit about just the epidemiology of skin cancer. You know, which patients are we talking about as a population that end up seeing you?
Yeah, certainly. And again, thank you for having me. It's an honor and pleasure to speak to you. So my practice is basically focused on Mohs surgery or skin cancer surgery. But general dermatology as a whole, you know, with skin cancer, it tends to be patients who are later in their life who've lived long enough to have enough sun damage. It tends to be fair-skinned individuals. It's kind of what I tell my patients is if you're fair enough and you live long enough and you've had enough sun, then your risk factor is going to be high enough that you might come see me. You know, the reason it's important to talk about is that it's a pretty high cost burden. It's, you know, approaching $10 billion a year in terms of overall cost for skin cancers. And it truly is the most common skin cancer across the board. So you can talk about epidemiology, 1 in 5 Americans will develop skin cancer, and overall skin cancers are more common than breast, prostate, lung, and colon cancer combined. So it's certainly something to talk about. It's certainly something to work together with our physicians and in the community. And obviously I'm biased, but I think it's a very important cause.
Yeah, absolutely. As a family doctor, I'm very indoctrinated into looking at what the United States, the USPSTF, I always get the order of those things wrong, but and I was noting that there's insufficient evidence to necessarily screen for skin cancer. So, you know, what does that mean for the primary care physicians out there?
Sure.
Give us a little guidance about how we're not to miss things.
Absolutely. I think it's tough because, you know, hopefully with especially a lot of our professional societies on the dermatology side have pushed for things like limiting risk factors like tanning, bed use, and trying to get awareness out there about sun protection and sun avoidance during peak sun hours. I think that's helped. And I think it's hard, you know, when I have the honor of lecturing like the family medicine program locally or the internal medicine program. You know, it's a common question is like, you know, if someone hasn't had a lot of sun, if they don't have a lot of moles, like, you know, how often should they get their skin checked? And I would say you're right. There's not like a great tried and true, you know, one size fits all sort of thing. I think what I tell people is from a primary care standpoint, I think it's good to just get everybody undressed. You know, you get kind of a baseline look at their skin. It makes your exam easier. But then beyond that, I would say if you're not noticing a lot of things that look suspicious, like a lot of moles or a lot of sun damage, you know, other than counseling about about sun protection and sun avoidance, I don't think it's unreasonable for someone to say, you know, maybe every 3 to 5 years having a full skin check, you know, with a dermatologist. Certainly there's some patients that are more anxious about it given family history and things like that. Mm-hmm. But I would generally say every 3 to 5 years for like kind of a low risk patient, you know, if they have a diagnosis of a skin cancer, usually we'll see them, kind of the general recommendation from the American Academy of Dermatology is for them to have a full body skin check every 6 months for the first 5 years, because they're a little higher risk of developing more. But even for us as dermatologists, if after 5 years, we're not diagnosing a skin cancer, we'll start to space them out further to every year, and then maybe every couple of years thereafter.
Okay. Well, that's helpful. Thanks. And then, you know, you talked about the incidence of skin cancer, but I know that one skin cancer is drastically different from another. And, you know, talk sure. about the difference, maybe, like, what's the percentage of cancers that could actually take a person's life, especially if left untreated?
Yeah, thankfully, it's fairly low. I mean, if you think about kind of the big three of basal cell carcinoma, squamous cell carcinoma, and melanoma, thankfully, the least aggressive overall is basal cell carcinoma, and it's also the most common. So mm-hmm. kind of comparing the top two, BCC for basal and SCC for squamous, basal cell carcinomas are about 4 times as common as squamous cell carcinoma. And then both of them are significantly more common, thankfully, than melanoma, which kind of cell for cell, pound for pound, is one of the more deadly skin cancers, really accounts for, you know, higher percentages of mortality in terms of its frequency. So mm-hmm. thankfully, basal cell carcinoma is the most common cancer across the board. Generally, what I tell people for basal and then also to some extent squamous, you know, anything that's new or changing or not healing is kind of the key. So sometimes people will lump basal and squamous cell carcinoma into just what we call keratinocyte carcinoma, mm-hmm. which just means, you know, kind of a squamous epithelium cancer or an epithelial cancer of the skin. And generally speaking, by and large, those are not going to be life-threatening, especially basal cell carcinoma. Okay. So if you're talking just BCC and SCC, what I counsel patients on for BCC is that the risk of metastasis is going to be closer to 0% than 1%. They're more just locally destructive, which is why we want to remove them. You know, they tend to be on sun-exposed areas of the body, you know, head and neck mostly. So those can be cosmetically disfiguring, or more importantly, functionally. Cause a functional impact, essentially. So those are important to remove from those standpoints. Squamous cell carcinoma is a little higher risk of metastasis by comparison. I tell people across the board, it's typically less than 5%. Okay. There are some features that we can go over that say, you know, if you feel comfortable taking a biopsy, you know, being able to communicate with your pathologist or your dermatopathologist about certain histologic features that can risk stratify squamous cell carcinoma. Happy to go over. But then, if, like I said, thankfully, melanomas are less common in most data is showing that we're catching them overall earlier as far as the histology and risk associated with that goes. So overall, I think we're doing a fairly good job, could always be better. But I would say those are kind of the general broad strokes of the top three.
Okay, great. And which are you typically treating?
I'm largely, it really follows that percentage. I'm largely treating basal cell carcinomas and squamous cell carcinomas. Mm-hmm. And then beyond that are melanomas. And then of course, so melanomas get screened to where I tend to take care of the thin melanomas. Mm-hmm. So the most recent AJCC8 criteria from a couple of years ago, basically anything. So melanoma is the most important factor as far as determining risk of metastasis is the depth of invasion of the tumor. Mm-hmm. So anything beyond 0.8 millimeters depth of invasion means that the patient should at least have a consideration of a sentinel lymph node biopsy, because that may risk stratify them into a different level of treatment category as far as some of the newer systemic agents that an oncologist could offer.
Okay.
So for my practice, I tend to get an in situ melanoma, which means a zero depth melanoma, or a thinly invasive melanoma less than 0.8 millimeters.
Okay. And the natural history of these, if a person doesn't, you know, say a person said, oh, I meant to go see Dr. D'Souza and then to get my less than 0.8 millimeter skin lesion excised with Mohs, but then something happened or COVID happened and 2 years later, is that somebody who's going to be at high risk for a more invasive surgery, or what's the timeline of this?
Yeah. If you don't mind? Yeah. Great question. You know, I tell my patients, I always wish it was gone yesterday, but, I get that life gets in the way and, you know, we as much as we can, we try not to, pass judgment, you know, especially the last couple of years have been rough for all of us. And so, for a melanoma in general, I'm trying to get patients in within a couple of weeks, which can be challenging. Same for a more aggressive squamous cell carcinoma. For a less aggressive squamous cell carcinoma, or most basal cell carcinomas that say are not symptomatic at the moment, waiting a month or two is not going to make a huge difference. Thankfully, especially basal cell carcinomas tend to be pretty slow growing. So it's something that's not as urgent, but I would say certainly with a melanoma or a squamous cell carcinoma that may have some more aggressive features, it's something that we would try to prioritize and which we tend to try and prioritize those patients in our practice as well.
Okay. That's helpful. And a person needs a referral to get to your office. Is that correct?
In general, although, you know, we try to be as flexible as possible with people. You know, we of course have a lot of like snowbirds, and we have a lot of people coming up from Florida. So there's kind of a mix of referrals, you know, a lot of times just from word of mouth, you know, kind of just in our community now being here almost 10 years, we'll get a lot of people calling and saying, hey, you know, my doctor said we should see you, or my friend says I should see you, but I've got a pathology report from, you know, Florida or New York or something like that. And we try to work with people as best we can. We just want to take good care of people.
Great. So on the, you mentioned that if you're fair-skinned enough, if you live long enough, I know the incidence of these skin cancers is pretty high when you're over 65. You know, is there sort of, you know, I know with a lot of skin cancers, you know, we think of functional status and we think of, do you need that next colonoscopy when you're 89 and you're really homebound? Is there an end point to, you know, sort of life expectancy that we should be thinking when we're referring somebody for a surgical excision?
Absolutely. That's a great question. And we try to do the same with patients. You know, we don't want every nail to need a hammer per se. It's certainly a discussion as we consider rationing healthcare costs and, you know, a limited way to cover all these different procedures. And a lot's been written about, especially in the decade, about life expectancy and sort of what's the right answer. I would say that most studies, there's actually a good one in JAMA Dermatology in May of last year, basically looking at patients older than 85 that had Mohs surgery. And in general, you know, looking at a number of different factors, to some extent it self-selected for older individuals that were essentially higher functioning in general, like high functional status, as well as kind of like higher risk tumors located in kind of more delicate areas of the face. So I wish I had a great answer, but I would tell you in general, maybe it's also our really active community of Western North Carolina, but I get some really active 90-year-olds, you know, and sometimes if they've got a rapidly growing skin cancer on the face, then I don't think it's unreasonable to do Mohs. A lot has been written about with Mohs, and this has been for decades about its cost efficacy. So again, I know I'm biased, but you know, my procedure is done as an outpatient. It's all done under local anesthetic. You know, within the course of a few hours, someone has a potentially aggressive tumor removed, and then essentially reconstructed. So, you know, it really typically often only involves 1 day of treatment or a half day of treatment. So, combining its higher cure rates and potential for lower costs, again, as an outpatient with local anesthetic, you're also essentially bundling the services of a surgeon and a pathologist under one physician. So I think a lot of those factors are helpful. I definitely think it's a tough answer as far as someone's overall life expectancy. And that's where myself, as a Mohs surgeon, I really rely on my referring physicians. You know, I think we're all trying to risk stratify the same patient and make sure that it's something that seems worthwhile for them.
Yeah. Well, thank you for your thoughtful answer to that. You know, we all want to work together on.
Absolutely.
Another thing that, you know, I'm imagining kind of honestly a rich white person doing this, but I'm looking at melanoma 5-year survival rates, and when the CDC numbers from 2023, I guess the survival rate for a white non-Hispanic person was 92.3%, 89% for a person of American Indian descent, 83% for a Hispanic individual, 77% for somebody of AAPI, and 68% for a Black non-Hispanic person. And just wondering how we can affect those numbers here in our local community and make things more equitable.
Absolutely. And you have so many great questions. I agree. I think some of it is the stereotype that, you know, only a fair-skinned individual is going to get a skin cancer. And there's been a lot written about, you know, essentially like the time of diagnosis or, you know, how aggressive the cancer is at the time of diagnosis for someone who's non-white. So I think that's where I go back to, you know, I think it's great to have access to care and have access to primary care. And I'm a big proponent of having everybody undress, look at them head to toe. It's something that can be done fairly quickly. And I think it makes your examination much easier on a primary care side. So I think that's certainly potentially a barrier to care. Is just having that access overall and essentially screening everybody.
Yeah, absolutely. Prevention is key, it sounds like. And if we can catch people at a low stage, then we can really have great, much better success in treatment results.
I totally agree.
You know, we covered a lot of the questions that I had, but we didn't specifically talk about the Mohs surgery. And you gave us some great information about, you know, how you're the pathologist and you're able to look at those margins. But can you give us a little bit more detail before we close about what your operation entails?
Yeah, absolutely. So all that Mohs surgery really entails is a more thorough evaluation of the margins. So compared to a traditional excision or a standard surgery, when tissue is excised, with a regular surgery, the way that it's processed is with the vertical sections. So it's often referred to as bread loafing, like how you sort of slice vertically through a loaf of bread. And studies show that you're really looking at less than 1% of the true cut margin. So the way that you get around that and get an acceptable cure rate with a traditional excision is by taking a larger margin. But if you could imagine, you know, the most common places where I work on the head and neck, you know, particularly the nose, lips, eyelids, ears, those are kind of our highest, certainly noses and ears are sort of the most common places that I work. You can imagine that taking a larger margin could be functionally, cause more functional impairment and be cosmetically disfiguring. So with Mohs, instead of doing vertical sections, when I cut out a skin cancer, I take it into our lab, which is on site, and I try to manipulate the tissue to lay it flat. So if you can imagine, say a full pie, you're trying to get that edge crust, those edge margins, you're trying to get them to lay flat, and then you're sectioning horizontally. So you're trying to take a 3D shape and turn it into 2D and look at 100% of the deep and peripheral margins. So compared to a traditional surgery where you're looking at, you know, at maybe at best less than 2% of the cut edge, with Mohs, you're truly trying to look at 100% of the margin. So it gets processed in our lab with frozen section histology or frozen section processing, and then it gets stained with hemocoxylin and eosin. And then I look at it under the microscope. I also end up placing hash marks on the tissue and the patient, which are basically just organization marks. So in my practice, that tends to be, you know, 12 o'clock on the patient, 3 o'clock, 6 o'clock, 9 o'clock, some variation of that. And I place ink in those little hash marks before I hand it off to our lab technician. So when I look under the microscope, I can, you know, if there are any, you know, as people say, any roots or fingers going wider or deeper, I can map out exactly where that is on the patient. So, you know, if I have to take more tissue, I go right back in on the you know, with basically within an hour or so, I go right back in. The patient's often still numb from the initial anesthetic, and I can take just that positive margin rather than a whole nother donut. So Mohs, for a multitude of reasons, it gets you a much higher cure rate, which is really the key aspect. But it also allows me to spare as much normal tissue as possible, which hopefully lends itself better to a, you know, for the patient, a smaller, nicer scar that's, you know, less cosmetically concerning, less functionally impactful. But it also lends to hopefully a more simple reconstruction, which in effect also tries to keep the cost down. So that's basically how the day works, you know, because it's all local anesthetic. I tell my patients they can eat and drink like normal. There's, you know, not a lot of restrictions as far as that goes. You know, everybody has a wireless device now, and so I was told them to bring something to keep them entertained, or at least bring a good book. You know, they're welcome to bring loved ones with them, you know, both from just a comfort standpoint, but just to help them pass the time. So generally speaking, within about 4 to 6 hours, sometimes even less, rarely more, we have their skin cancer off of them with a high degree of cure rate.
That's amazing. Any special considerations for our patients who may be diabetic or who may be on blood thinners or who may have had history of skin infections?
Sure. Yeah. So, you know, most studies show, so I mentioned diabetes, blood thinners, and then a history of infection. So for diabetes, I generally tell people, you know, we as we all do, we have sort of like a patient intake sheet. So kind of some of their main comorbidities are high on our concern list. So like if a patient's having an issue, we'll either rope in their loved ones, or we have that sort of go-to sheet of like, hey, these might be the most common issues for them. For diabetics, we tell them, you know, again, they can eat and drink like normal, bring snacks, but we also have them on site if need be. So generally speaking, people do pretty well from that standpoint. As far as blood thinners go, most surgeons nowadays, we don't stop blood thinners, you know, unless they have a bad history of bleeding. You know, that those are the times we'll want to loop in their primary care physician or their cardiologist potentially. because we want their approval and we want that to be done in a safe manner. But by and large, I tell patients that there's, you know, no major concern from a life-threatening standpoint. I'd much rather have to meet them in the middle of the night to cauterize something than have them have a clot that could be much more serious. So in general, we tell patients to take their blood thinners like normal, and we can cauterize in the office, and for the most part, people do quite well.
Mm-hmm.
And as far as infection goes, yeah, there are certain things that I do. In general, the infection rates are very low. And if you can imagine, you know, most of the time working on the head and neck, there's a really amazing blood supply. So generally the infection rate's less than 2%.
Mm-hmm.
That's a little higher depending on where we're working. So we're working on a lower extremity, that's typically going to be double the risk of infection. So depending on where we're working, we may use some prophylactic antibiotics or some postoperative antibiotics just as a precaution. You know, if for whatever reason I have to do a slightly more complicated reconstruction, say a skin flap in say like on an oral mucosa, or say a skin graft in an inner wrist in a site area that I'm concerned about, sometimes I'll do a short course of postoperative antibiotics.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes we'll do topical antibiotics, you know, depending on the patient's risk factors. But as much as we can, we try to do our part to not overprescribe and contribute to any kind of resistance.
Great. Thank you. I thought of one other question I hadn't asked, which is, are there any real common barriers to care? You know, I mentioned sort of that vague, like, you know, COVID happened and I didn't get in for 2 years.
Sure.
But what are other barriers and how can we as a medical community kind of overcome those together?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think one of the big barriers is just, you know, the patients that tend to be older, and even though they may have overall high daily functioning, you know, sometimes it's as simple as transport, as simple as having a loved one, you know, or a friend in the community that can help them with something as simple as travel. Or, you know, there's always the potential for some challenge with taking care of the wound thereafter. So trying to have some of those resources in place can be helpful.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we certainly try to do our part of telling the patient, you know, we're happy to do bandage changes. We're happy to talk them through it. We try to, as much as possible, you know, if they don't have help, or say it's a site that's hard for them to reach or see, we try to do you know, bandages or suturing techniques that need a little less care.
Mm-hmm. Are you seeing any folks who live in long-term care?
Yes, absolutely. So, you know, you hope that there's a threshold or a line that all across the board are being met for nursing homes. But we all know, right, there's different levels of care.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, not that I remember the names of specific places, but there's certain places where I feel like, you know, if they have nursing tied in and they're having someone actively involved in their day-to-day wound care, then I'll have less concern there.
Okay.
Versus and some of that's leaning in on what the patient tells me and what their loved ones tell me, just trying to do our best to make sure that their site's well cared for.
Awesome. Well, I'm sorry I skipped around, just kind of thinking of different questions that your answers raise. So thank you for jumping around there with me. I appreciate your flexibility.
No, it's my pleasure. I hope I'm doing it in an eloquent enough fashion.
You're answering all my questions. Thank you so much. What else haven't I asked you about that that you would like to convey to us?
No, you've asked some great questions, hard hitting questions. I think overall, I mean, I think the biggest point to drive home is that, hey, we're all fighting the same battle together, even if it's in our own, if it's in our own niche. And just I can't tell whoever's listening enough that, you know, if I or our practice as a whole can ever be of help to you or your patients, like we want to be there for you and we want to be available to you. And, you know, whatever barriers there may be, maybe this is too much of a kumbaya moment, but I think we can come together and solve them. And it's just an honor and pleasure to be part of this community and to talk to you. And I just can't tell you enough how lucky and blessed I feel to be here, and that we just want to offer great care to those around us.